Welcome. We're glad you've joined us for this Hand in Hand podcast. Hand in Hand is a nonprofit organization, and we provide information, classes, training, and lots of support for parents like you. We call our approach Parenting by Connection, and it's based on the insight that you deserve good support as you parent, and every child needs lots of connection in order to thrive. We offer tools to help you foster support for yourself and connection in your family. We hope this podcast gives you exactly the kind of support you're looking for.
So I want to welcome all of you to We Can Stop Spanking. It's our hand-in-hand free teleseminar of the week, and this is the month of the Stop Spanking campaign. And I have with me Robin Peters-Bennett, who I'll introduce in just a few minutes. I'll just let you know a little bit about Hand in Hand in case this might be your first teleseminar with us. We're a nonprofit organization. I'm the founder and the program director. My name is Patty Whipler, and I'm so glad to have you with us tonight. We are here to bring emotional support to parents and to bring information to parents about how children's emotional lives work so that we can understand the beautiful beings we've brought into the world, so that we can be gentler with them than our parents were with us, and so that we can help make sure that their intelligence stays fresh and lively and big. When you treat children well, their intelligence stays quite powerful, and when children are not treated well, they lose their native intelligence, their ability to play and cooperate, they lose their ability to be well in the world, they lose their ability to feel like they can meet the challenges of their lives. And we want to help parents help their children preserve that kind of intelligence. And in order to do that, we teach listening tools to parents. And these are tools both for parents and for parents to use with their children. We teach parents how to listen well to one another so that you can begin to provide significant emotional support to another parent, and they can learn to provide significant emotional support to you for the emotional work of parenting. Like, parenting takes all of our heart and all of our soul. We really want to do it well, and when it doesn't go well, we have lots of feelings about it. And when our children feel like their lives aren't going well, they have oodles of feelings about that too. And no one really has helped us growing up to understand what to do with feelings, why they're there, and how not to suffer the same negative feelings about ourselves or about other people over and over and over again, how to get out of that loop. And the parent-to-parent listening tools help parents get out of that loop, and the parent-child listening tools are ways that parents can connect with children well so that when children are upset, when they have something they're scared of, when they're sad, when they are really afraid of being there without us, when they've met with an unfortunate circumstance that really has frightened them or saddened them, we know what to do. We know how to help. We know how to listen. We know how to allow them to release the feelings that they have stored up that have made them frightened or sad. And we know how to play with them well. We know how to support them through play and through eliciting laughter and making times really fun. So these are the tools that we offer parents. We've got lots of free resources online at handinhandparenting.org. We've got over 100 articles. You just use a little search box at the top of the homepage there for any topic that you're interested in finding out more about, and finding out how one can be thoughtful of children's feelings and help them with the emotional roadblocks that they come up with during their complicated young lives. So that's about us. Our approach is called Parenting by Connection, and it is in line with all the latest research about the importance of attachment and the importance of really making sure that parents have emotional support in order to do the work of parenting. So we are hand-in-hand parenting, and I want to introduce now Robin Peters-Bennett. She is going to give the bulk of the information in this teleseminar. She's a psychotherapist, and she's a child mental health specialist who works with children and adults who are suffering from the effects of early abuse and neglect. She specializes in working with children who have been adopted from the foster care system, who are struggling with a myriad of mental health problems. Robin is also the founder of StopSpanking.org, a nonprofit online educational resource that's aimed at raising awareness on the risks of spanking. And she's on the steering committee of the U.S. Alliance to End the Hitting of Children, and an organization that's dedicated to ending all forms of violence against children. And I was first exposed to Robin with one of her great TED Talks on spanking and its damaging effects on children. And Robin, I really want to welcome you. I'm so proud to have you with us tonight.
Well, it's such a privilege to be here, Patty. I'm so excited to have a chance to talk with parents.
It's so
marvelous that they've called in, and, you know, one of the things I want to say is that maternal skills are not instinctual in large part, and I think a lot of parents feel that they should already know things. I was listening to Dr. Bruce Perry, who's a neuropsychologist that also studies, you know, evolution in essence, and he said we can lose our parenting skills within two generations, that we primarily learn to parent in our environment from our relationships. So I'm so glad that Hand in Hand is out there.
Yeah, thank you. But what I'd like to do, how we're going to structure this call, is I'm going to give the floor to Robin, and she's going to talk to us about how we can stop spanking. And we'll give the floor to her for a while. I'm going to have a few things to add, some of the nuggets of information from Hand in Hand that I think are really pertinent to this topic, and then we will try to save about 20 minutes for question and answer on this call. So think about your questions, and I'll give you a way to raise your hand on the call so I can see that you want to ask a question, and I will call on as many people as I can in the remaining time. So Robin, tell us how we can stop spanking.
Well, I think the very first thing is to recognize that spanking is harmful. 95% of all parents spank their children at some point in time, even if they don't think it's the right thing to do. It's very common. My own interest in this topic has to do with, I study, of course, the effects of violence in the family in early childhood and what that does to the developing brain and to the child's ability to function. And what's interesting is that I've been reading a lot about the research on spanking, and I find that, in fact, the negative outcomes are very similar. So just to kind of put this into a bigger context and to support why I believe that spanking is not a personal choice and that, in fact, it's a form of domestic violence that's been passed on from one generation to another that seems normal to us. You know, there was this incredible study done by the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Health Plan of over 17,000 middle-class Americans. And what they found is that early family dysfunction is highly correlated to all sorts of physical health problems, emotional problems, drug and alcohol abuse, suicide. It's stunning. And so one of the things that this study helped us understand is that 29% of the people that were asked said that they had been physically abused in their childhood, not including spanking. So physical violence is a huge problem in our culture. And the reason spanking ties into this is that it's highly correlated to what they call overt physical abuse. It's if you believe in spanking, you're four times more likely to meet the criteria for child abuse and be reported to CPS. If you use implements like a spoon or a belt or a paddle, your likelihood of abusing your child, according to law, is nine times. So it's highly correlated, and we know that most child abuse cases begin with a parent. Physical child abuse begins with a parent trying to use physical discipline. And spanking is really profoundly prevalent in our culture. There's several studies showing that nearly 30% of children under 15 months old, babies, are spanked. And we know that 50% of all toddlers are spanked three or more times a week. So this is a chronic and this is a chronic condition, and it has an impact on the way that a child's brain develops. So the take-home message here is that little children are the most vulnerable. And unfortunately, the spanking of little children has not changed. Actually, in the last 20 years, there's been quite a decline in general, but not with little children, toddlers. So I want to talk a little bit about, just so you can understand, why is spanking destructive, particularly, you know, if you just hit them a couple times on the bottom and you don't leave bruises and you try to use it as a behavioral tool. So essentially, spanking is linked to a lot of these emotional problems and behavioral problems, even into adulthood. We know that children are more aggressive if you spank them. And the reason we believe this is the case, there's a lot of emotional reasons, but also it seems to be that it dysregulates the self-regulatory equipment of the brain. And that is what allows you to stay calm. Self-regulatory equipment essentially is your ability. It's a lot of things. One is it's your ability to stay calm under pressure, to deal with frustration. It's also physiological. It's your respiration and your perspiration and your heart rate. And so if, you know, little children, their self-regulation is developing in the first 4 years, and if that's altered by too much stress, particularly stress coming from the parent, it can make them more vulnerable to being easily irritated, easily aroused, not just emotionally but physically. Like sound can bother them more, and textures can bother them more, and too much, too many lights, too many crowds. So it's a physical kind of sensitivity to the environment. And so one of the things to remember is that, you know, if you want your child to have this ability to get along with others and to have empathy and to be able to affiliate with other children and get along with their siblings, that skill only comes first. What comes is attachment between the mom and the child. And from there, you get self-regulation. And when the child's self-regulated, then they can handle being in preschool. They can handle having to wait their turn, or they are able to cope with all the children running around and not always winning a game, or wanting a toy and not being able to get it. So it's really important to understand that spanking can interfere with attachment. It can make the child feel ambivalent. An interesting study just came out that showed that it was like 10,000 children, four out of 10 children had an insecure attachment. And that's a pretty serious thing, because we know that an insecure attachment leads to problems later on. Essentially, an insecure attachment makes it harder to self-regulate. So it's super important that children feel attached. And we know that Elizabeth Gershoff is a researcher, and she studied hundreds of studies on spanking, but she found that 9 studies out of 9 on attachment showed that spanking compromises the bond. So we know that attachment is the foundation for self-regulation. So the last thing I just want to say is that, so how do we help our children self-regulate? How do we help them be calm? And the important thing to think about is that our children do well when they are not aroused, and when they're aroused, it's harder for them to do well. So their level of functioning is dependent on the state of arousal. So what we're really trying to do is help children not get too aroused. And you can see that spanking is very arousing, because the brain sees it as a threat, and it puts the child into a compliance and a submission state, but it at risk of them not really being able to stay self-regulated. So a lot of parents will say, well, how do I deal with tantrums? And, you know, they're just trying to deal with, you know, my child is 3 and she flips out and has a tantrum in the store or whatever. and how do I hang in? And I know that Patty has a lot to say about how to do that. I think it's super important to be able to be with a child when they're tantruming. But also, I want you to think about how do we actually enrich and develop a child's capability for self-regulation. So from a brain perspective, we want to give them experiences when they are calm, when they are engaged with us, that are patterned and repetitive and consistent. And you want them to be pleasing to the body, like movement and walking and running and laughing and smiling and all of those physical kinds of things, lots of physical touch, within the context of being related to them, being connected to them. And so one of the things I talk about a lot is how regulated are you as a mom or a dad? You know, because adults can push themselves a lot more than little children. And so often what you'll see is that children will express how stressed out the whole family is. So where you can skip a meal and drink coffee and not sleep very well and rush to the grocery store late in the evening and you can push yourself and still be okay. Really, children are telling us where our physiological limits are because their brains are not as developed. They can't really cope with that kind of stress. So part of keeping a child regulated is to be really in contact with your own body experience. One person wrote in and said, when I'm PMSing, what do I do so that I'm not losing it? And I would say really trust your body. You know, when your body doesn't feel well, alter your schedule. Don't push. Because anytime you push yourself, you're pushing your child. And they don't have the same kind of neurological capacity to cope with that. Patty, what do you think?
I think one of the tools that we like to offer parents and is the tool of listening partnerships, where I think our take is that we are full of unresolved emotions from our own childhoods, from being with our own parents when they were stressed, and our own parents gave us as much love as they could possibly give us. And parents are really poorly supported. So when they were stressed and beyond the beyond, they said things to us that they probably didn't mean or wish they hadn't said. They did things with us and to us that, are not good things to do with children, that frightened us and made us feel bad about ourselves and made us worry about whether we were loved. And those experiences are held inside the emotional memory. And when we're with young children, the stresses of our own childhood are pretty easily triggered, so that when our children do things that were not permitted by our parents or the things that our parents blew up at, we all of a sudden find ourselves, having said to ourselves in the morning, okay, I'm going to stay really calm today, I'm going to keep a lid on it. And then our child does the thing that was severely punished when we were children. We saw it, or we were the victims of the punishment. And before you know it, the feelings that are unresolved, the upset that we have from what we went through, is all of a sudden ignited, but we're in the powerful role. So we wind up saying things to our children and doing things to our children that have gotten passed down through our families by this mechanism of, the hurt people hurt people. Someone has a hurt and it's not resolved. They can be triggered, and they can be triggered in such a way as to visit the hurt on someone that was visited upon them or something like it. And yeah, what we're really big on is helping parents listen to one another so that we can talk about, where parenting is hard, where we are challenged, where we want to go with our parenting. And when we've built a safe relationship, when someone has listened to us well, to offload the leftover feelings from way back when that come up around our children. It feels like our children make us feel this way, but actually they kind of set off the triggers for old stuff that we've been carrying around since we were little. And that laughter and crying and tantrums are ways of getting the emotional gunk out of the storage lockers and sort of defusing it, so that a good cry when you've got PMS or before you've got PMS. I know one of our instructors has just been experimenting with making sure that she gets good listening time when her period's about to come, because PMS drives her nuts and makes her not the mama she wants to be. And it really makes a difference to be able to just roar with feelings with someone who understands you, not at your children, but, you know, to your listening partner. And it can really change how you are in those stressful situations to have a regular listener that you can take your feelings to once a week. It makes a huge difference. And then you don't have to pay for this. You just, you know, give the person who listened to you the listening time back. And it can be, well, actually, there are several parents in Hand in Hand who've been doing listening partnerships for 20 years with one another. And these are parents who are not in easy situations and who've really helped one another out in significant ways. So we really recommend listening partnerships.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting about that, too, is that, you know, of course, these memories from childhood can be triggered. It's also interesting to learn that there's physiological memory, meaning that you can have all sorts of associations to sound, to too much noise. If you were raised in a very chaotic early environment, you know, just the sound of little children screaming or yelling or just too much noise can activate your arousal. So arousal
yep.
isn't always emotional. Sometimes you don't feel anything, but all of a sudden your chest hurts or your heart's racing or you just feel physically anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really important to understand, to just be able to recognize that that's happening to your body, because children take cues off your body in just an amazing way, and they know if you're relaxed or they know if you're starting to get aroused. And you don't even have to figure out what it is necessarily in the moment, but just to be aware, oh, I'm starting to get irritable. I'm starting to find noise annoying.
Yeah.
And if you can do that, if you can just become aware of your body, then you can give your body signals that let your body know you're really actually safe. You're not in a real chaotic or dangerous environment. So sometimes what I tell parents is just to announce it. I do this with my granddaughter. I'll say, okay, I'm really getting irritable, and I need it to be quieter, and I'm having a hard time. And she loves me. She's quite sensitive. She'll go, oh, you see, because it's not about her.
Mm-hmm.
And so she doesn't feel blamed. And then
no.
sometimes I'll just retreat. Sometimes what can really help the lower brain, because we can get into, when you get into that lower brain reactive state where your self-regulatory equipment is on hyper-arouse,
mm-hmm.
what happens is you can't think about things. It's not really, you can't think in a complex way because that part of your brain shuts down. So if you go and you just say, when I feel this way, I'm going to go get a glass of water, or I'm going to walk outside. Walking in particular, even if you just walk down the block and back, just announce to your children, I'm going to be back, I have to take a cool down. That walking actually regulates the lower brain. And when you breathe, be really aware of your breath and make sure your exhale is a little longer than your inhale. And what that does is it calms the sympathetic system, and it tells your brain, oh, I'm actually okay, I'm not in danger. And it allows you to regain the parts of your brain that stay connected to your children, the part of your brain that has empathy. Because when
mm-hmm.
we're angry, we lose empathy. It's just not possible to have empathy when you're really upset.
Yeah, yeah, we feel embattled.
You know, there was
go ahead.
Well, I just noticed that one of the writers said, someone wrote in and said, what happens if I do lose my cool and hit my child? And, you know, I wanted to just say, I think there's a really graceful way you can deal with that. And one is to apologize and just say, I'm sorry, I flipped my lid, I lost control. And just take responsibility for it. And the other thing would be to ask them what it was like for them. And do this when you're calm, not when you're in that place of kind of maybe self-hatred, where you're kind of being hard on yourself. Because those of us that lose our cool have often been punished for it, and so we'll punish ourselves. When you can move out of that and you're back in a calm place where you can be kind to yourself, then you can talk to them and say, well, what was it like for you? And then make a plan. Say, okay, in the future when I start to get upset like that, I think I'm going to walk outside on the porch. How would you feel? Would that be okay if I did that? And you just talk about it, because it also helps model to them, what should they do when they start to lose their cool?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the three strategies for when you're heading out into the beyond, your emotions
yes.
are, you know, governing your whole self.
Right.
One of the strategies that I like to recommend is that parents do a mommy or daddy is getting mad drill. And you just take your little children and you gather them around. And this is at a time when you're not angry and you're not upset and you're actually feeling just fine. You save this for that time and you just say, okay, I'm going to show you the new thing I'm going to do so I don't get so mad at you. When I'm feeling upset, I'm going to walk into my room here, you know, and then you bring the children in. And see this little part of the wall here where there's no picture? Well, I'm going to want to get my upset out, not at you, but at the wall. So I'm going to pound the wall, just like this. You know, and you just kind of do a little cartoon anger thing, and you pound the wall, or you stomp on the carpet, or maybe you've decided you want to hit your fist on the bed, or hit your fist on the couch. You do that, but you take yourself away from where they would be, and you make yourself a little anger spot, and you show them what you're going to do there, and you do it, but you cartoon it so that they can laugh a little bit, so you can laugh a little bit, and then you go, okay, let's practice. Let's go back in the living room, and you guys can, you know, let's pretend that you're fighting, and I'm getting mad, and I'm going to go, oh, I have to go to my little anger spot. Here I go, and then you run, you know, cartoon-like again in, and you pound on the wall, and have a chance to laugh, and everybody has a chance to be kind of jolly about it. But then when you do start steaming up, sometimes what will happen is your children will tell you, you know, Daddy, you need to go to your spot in your bedroom. It's time for you to do that. And they actually, it's infuriating, actually, when you're angry. Your children being sensible is, escalates the feeling. But what we find is that when most of our anger comes from feelings of fear, it doesn't feel like fear, it feels like something entirely different, but we're scared inside. We're scared that we're losing control. We're scared that we're going to be victimized like we were when we were, you know, and there's not any sense to it, but we're scared. We do not want to be victimized. We refuse to be victimized, and so we're ready to attack. And what allows us to become less scared, one of the things that allows us is, it's a little bit like what you said, Robin, about walking, is physical activity helps our bodies remember that we're big, helps our bodies remember that we are not going to be dominated by our children. And so pounding, jumping, making noise, growling, you know, being kind of out there, but at the wall, or out in the garage, at the punching bag, or some little designated place. It's like your children don't have to see you. You can close the door behind you if you're afraid that, you know, seeing you that upset is going to frighten them. But you do need to take it somewhere, not aim it at them. And children can help you with that. It's just one of our strategies. It's not a long-term strategy. What really helps long-term is enough crying about the times you were victimized when you were a child, so that you undo those emotional triggers. You take care of that emotional baggage. You get a chance to fight for yourself with your listening partner. I mean, in your listening partnership, you get a chance to grieve your losses and be heated about the insults that you suffered, so that you are less reactive and under pressure in real life.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because when we're reactive, the body is involved. And
always.
it always feels justified.
Yep.
And that has to do with what parts of the brain are available to us. So when you start to lose your cool, I think it helps me to realize that when I feel justified, I shouldn't trust that.
Mm-hmm.
And also to try to calm my body down. Because if you do calm the body down, then your mind can come back, and then you can pick up that phone and call your girlfriend and say, oh, my gosh, you have no idea. I'm so upset. Can I talk to you for 10 minutes while you walk around the block or get on the treadmill or get in a swing if you have one on the front porch or something where you're moving? Because the moving, the regulated repetitive moving is very helpful for lower brain regulation. I know for me, if I'm upset, 10 minutes into a walk, I'm a different person. And I haven't talked about anything. I haven't processed anything. It's just the physical experience itself.
That's so helpful.
Can be helpful.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing, too, is that what gets us to that level where we're so dysregulated, you know, are we filling our lives with expectations of others where we have to push ourselves beyond our own limits? Because in a way, a lot of times what happens is our children are the first to protest. You know, oh, I need to go to the bank, and then I have to go to the grocery store, and then we have to do this one more thing and this one more thing, and you're in the car, which is not regulating to children. It's restrictive, and you get a more irritated version of them by the time you're getting out of the car.
Yeah.
I think we live incredibly pressured lives that are not sensitive to our physical rhythms and our need for rhythmic, easy, low-pressure experience.
Yeah. We talk a lot about connection, that anytime you put a child in the car, unless you really work at staying connected, they feel disconnected. They're strapped down. They can't move. They're in the back seat. They can't see you. It's really going places in the car. It's disempowering to children, and that they lose their sense that we're thinking about them. And often for good reason, because often when we're going someplace, we can't pay attention to them 100%. We have to drive, and we have to think about, you know, how to organize the errands so that we have spend the least time in the car, and we're having to fight traffic, and our minds are preoccupied, and they can tell. And children get alarmed when they see their parents preoccupied. It feels to them like a stressful experience, because in truth, they are dependent on our ability to think about them and protect them. And when we're preoccupied, they can tell that we're not able to do that job very well. And all of this nonverbal communication from that they can pick up from us makes it hard for them to settle if we are not settled, if we are preoccupied, if we're too pressured, if we're stimulated, if our feelings are getting rattled by the number of things we're trying to do and how fast we're trying to do them. Yeah.
Yes.
Robin, I wanted to ask you, one of the parents who wrote in ahead of time wanted to know what you think about how to talk to friends who stink, or how to intervene when you see someone physically attacking their child in public. Those are two different things, really. It's the friends who believe in spanking, and it's the, you know, moving in to try to stop an incident when a child is really being hurt in public by their parent. And I'd just love to hear what you have to tell us about that.
You know, it's so difficult if you've already arrived at the conclusion that you don't want to spank to know that your friends are doing that. It's upsetting. And I think part of why this is such a hard topic is it upsets us, so we're not as sympathetic as we normally could be. I know I find it upsetting. But also, spanking can be linked for other people to trauma, and so they're exquisitely sensitive in ways that might be really quite surprising. And I think that the shame response in parents is enormous. And so even though you might be having just a conversation, I think right under the surface is the potential for that parent to feel very bad about doing the wrong thing. And so one thing I love about the neurobiological model and saying, you know, hey, there's a lot of research to show that it is correlated to all sorts of negative outcomes, and that it can even cause brain damage. It can affect the dopamine system. It can cause the hippocampus to be smaller. And a lot of these effects are not readily seen, because the way that the brain grows, it grows sequentially. So if you injure the self-regulatory system, you sometimes won't see real problems until the child's older, like 9, or sometimes even adolescence. And so I often tell parents, hey, you know, your mom and dad didn't know this, and this is new material, and we're all learning. So I always share the research, because, and I try to do it in a very non-judgmental way, because people at the time might just sort of go, oh, whatever, but they'll read it, and it'll start to sink in, and probably in the privacy of their own home, where they don't have to worry about feeling judged, they can look through that material. And think about it. Now, if it's a friend, you know, part of it is you can say to them, do you ever wish that you had alternatives, that you could actually avoid spanking? Can you give me a situation where you felt like you had to spank? And just try to understand their frustration as a parent and offer support. The other thing is if you know them really well, you can ask them, what was your first experience of violence as a child? Do you remember what it was like? And that's a deeper question to ask, and I think there has to be trust in the relationship. But that's where you're really getting at the core for an individual, is that they're repeating violence that was done to them. You know, with people in public, it's interesting. I saw a man one time slap his boy's face, and I didn't do anything. I was really afraid of him. He was a very big man. And I thought about that so many times. But I do often intervene. And I try to remember, well, first of all, I have to know that, yeah, I'm upset. This is an upsetting thing because I'm witnessing violence. We have mirroring neurons. We have empathy, and we feel for the child. So I try to remember that the parent looks aggressive, but they themselves are overwhelmed. They are dysregulated. They are in crisis. And so if I can think that way about them and find a way to feel connected to them before I even do anything, that is really helpful. I had a woman at the airport threatening her son, and I walked up to her and I put my hand on her shoulder and I said, I know you're doing the best that you can, and I hope that you can be gentle with yourself here. And this is a woman that was raging, and she just started to cry, and she told me her whole story about how her son's autistic, and her little girl, her 15-year-old daughter, is getting on the plane and is angry with her. And so we talked, and I just mostly listened. And during that time, the little boy climbed into her lap, and he started to calm down. So I think, really, we have to connect to the parent.
That's a really beautiful story.
It was just so heart-wrenching, you know. But I think we have to remember that parents are doing the best they can, but they're completely overwhelmed. And, you know, when you're angry, you often feel powerless.
Yep.
You don't feel powerful. But from our perspective, the person looks like a bully.
Yeah.
So try to get underneath the bully part and speak to the part of them that you know is too hard on themselves. That's why they're so hard on their children. They probably think they're a terrible parent. They're probably trying to control the child because they feel like people are going to judge them.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of anxiety. And, you know, I use physical touch sometimes, but you have to trust yourself, and you'll feel your way into the situation and just be authentic and care about them.
Yeah. Those are really good ideas. Robin, shall we open up the lines and see who has questions?
Yeah, that would be wonderful.
Hello?
Hello. Welcome.
Hi. I've been having problems with my toddler. It's like it just ignores me, and I try to be patient, but it's like I can't get him to stop doing things, and it's making me, I'm starting to yell, and I don't want to do that. And I've tried a lot of different things, like trying to breathe and trying to distract myself, and I just am not sure what to do with that because he just doesn't pay attention to me until I'm yelling.
Okay.
Well, you know, one thing I would say is that part of what makes us get kind of irritated with our children is what we think is going on. And mm-hmm. The interesting thing is a lot of parents will be like, okay, I'm trying to get everybody ready. We're going out the door, and my three-year-old's over there drawing, and they don't care. They're not listening. But the interesting thing about it is that children often draw or go inside of themselves or stop listening as a way to self-soothe if they believe that they're experiencing you as anxious. So what you'll see is a child will shut down and just be playing a game or drawing or doing something where you feel totally shut out. And I think for those of us that have been raised in homes where we weren't listened to, that could be really interpreted in a way that would make you feel very bad, like, oh, he's not listening. But instead, imagine that he's coping the best he can. And if he is sort of just sitting there and doing something and he's not hearing you, slow down, because you can imagine that probably you're moving a lot faster than he can tolerate. And you may also be giving him some directive that overwhelms him. So connect before you direct. And the best way to do that with children that are overwhelmed is not to talk from across the room, not to stand over them, but to get very close and to get down on their level and to get quiet for just a minute and sit down next to him with whatever he's doing. And for a moment, let go of what you need and just say to him, I notice you're drawing. And just spend a moment to connect to him. What are you drawing? Oh, or I notice that you're playing the game. And that's how you can get him to listen, is when you connect to him.
Yeah.
And when you feel like he's connecting, then you can say, Mommy really needs to get ready to go out the door, or can you help me? So, always make it about we. Can we do this together? You and me are on the same team here. We're not against each other ever. Can you help me? Because I'm worried we'll be late. And then he might be able to say, well, I don't know. How do you think he might respond to that?
Well, I don't know. I was just going to ask you what to do when that doesn't work.
Well, if it doesn't work, then it means he's really disconnected. So I would maybe let go of my agenda to be on time and try to understand what's happening with him. What might he be doing where he would...
I'd like to jump in here with a couple of listening tools, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think Robin's idea of connecting, when children aren't able to connect with us, when they're not able to listen, they can't think. They're disconnected and they can't think. And in order for children to be able to think, in order for their minds to open back up, they need to feel connected. And so the listening tool that we have to help your child get reconnected again is what we call special time. And when you notice there's a certain kind of situation that in which your child shuts down, I like the words you use there, Robin, your child is just, walls himself off. What you'll want to do is rather than hope that it doesn't happen again tomorrow, that when you're leaving for daycare, he is unresponsive to anything you say to him, assume that tomorrow he will be unresponsive to anything that you say, and he won't be listening to you, because it's been that way for the last, 25 days. So don't try to go on false hope. Just get ready and, start your morning routine a little earlier so that you can do 5 minutes of special time. And what you do with special time is you say, I will do anything you want to do. What do you want to do? And you get in close and you offer eye contact and you offer a little more touch than you usually might. And you let your child either say something or just keep doing what they're doing, and you absorb what they're doing and you be pleased pretty much no matter what. You don't let them ruin anything during special time. There are limits, but you don't announce those limits. You just pay attention for 5 minutes, and then your timer goes off, and you say, okay, special time needs to end now, and now we need to get in the car or, do whatever it is that he's been stonewalling you about doing. And if your child still doesn't feel connected, then what you do is you bring a limit. And the way we like to help parents set limits is to use your body. Don't say what the limit is more than once. We need to go to the car. And you see that your child is, squirming and turning away from you, and they still can't look at you. It means that there are bad feelings running around inside your child. And in order for him or her to connect, you're going to need to listen to those feelings. So you move in, you put your arms around him, and you say, come on, let's go. But you don't take him to the car. You don't try to get anything done. All you need to do is propose the thing that needs to happen that he or she can't cooperate with. And with a two-year-old, that's really all it will take to bring the feelings to the fore. The children will begin to fight you. They might have a tantrum. They might cry. They might tell you, Dad, Mommy, no, I don't want to go. And those are the feelings that have walled your child off. And if you can do what we call stay listening, you just keep saying it's time to go, or it's time to brush your teeth, or it's lunchtime, we need to go to the table, whatever the next thing is that, he doesn't want to do, you keep saying it. But you don't make him do it, because what he needs to do is concentrate on on spilling all of those feelings out, and he needs to feel your love going in. So you be quiet, you offer eye contact, and you let him cry. And the crying is like an emotional poop. It's getting undigested feelings, stuff that, you know, is not sitting well with him out of his system. And in its place, in pours the connection that you're offering. In pours your rapt attention. And the crying is not a sign that he's a bad boy. It's not a sign that he is regressing. It's not a sign that he wants to defy you. It's just a sign that he feels so bad he can't think. And if you can pay attention and connect while he's crying, and that means just a little bit of touch and lots of eye contact, even if he's not looking at you, and you just keep saying, I'm right here, I'm not going to go away. And when the crying slows down, you say, it's time to go to the car. And that will fire him up again if he still has feelings left. And when a child can offload the feelings, they feel so much closer to you afterwards because they got, the feelings were the barrier between you and your child. And they got rid of the feelings, the barrier goes down. They collect all of the love that you just poured in for the next, for 5 minutes or 10 minutes while they had their big cry. And they feel very close to you, and their behavior will clear up very nicely because they can think again, because they're now a reasonable human being. They don't have that emotional load sitting on them, confusing them, and separating them from you. So those are a few listening tools there. Special time, and then bringing the limit, and then stay listening while your child has. And two-year-olds have a lot of trouble with a lot of things. The world is pretty big. And a lot of things that we do don't make a whole lot of sense to them. So they do need time to offload all of the discomfort of being a small person in a big person's world. The world is pretty jostly placed for little two-year-olds, and they feel overwhelmed a lot, and they can get rid of that feeling very safely if you listen, and they come back to you in big time. They come back to you.
It's that's such a beautiful method. It's like children, really all children, but when you're upset, you're not cognitive, and a lot of words can just make it worse. But, you know, the simple phrases, the eye contact, being physically close, not being towering over them, being next to them, touching them, even making sounds like, oh, you know, like, oh, I know it's hard, or, you know, that just the love that you feel for them, knowing that they're having a hard time. It's not that he's not listening to you and that he doesn't love you and that he doesn't care about you. It's that he's really struggling and he can't connect to you and he's having a hard time.
Well, usually,
if you think about it.
Usually it's that he's playing and getting into stuff. And so, and I'll try to, you know, tell him to not do something, or, you know, I don't want you to do that. Can we do something else? Or, and he thinks it's funny, or he just, you know, he either laughs at me or he just blatantly just ignores me. And
yeah.
So I don't know how he feels. I mean, he's obviously having a good time, and I don't think that it's necessarily a bad thing all the time, but it still is always the ignoring, whether he's in a good mood or whether he's, you know, throwing a tantrum as well.
Yeah, yeah. The other listening tool that I'll just give you a hint of, we need to move on to a few other people who have questions, is what we call play listening, and that is promoting laughter, because laughter offloads fear, it offloads lots of tension, and it's a very strong connector of parent and child. So when he's getting into something and you say no and he looks at you and laughs and gets into it again, one of the things you can do in order to set limits and basically keep him out of stuff that, you know, is not good for him to be in the middle of, but still connect with him, is to go, Kenny, are you? And you kind of just pull him over into your lap and you go, ooh, you know, and you just kind of just jiggle him around a little bit. Oh, you did it again, you know. And then you stand him up and you go, let's go over here. And then he'll make a beeline for that thing that he really wants to do, and you go, oh no, that's the wrong way, come here you, and you pull him back into your lap again, and you give him a little playful jiggle, and you go, no, 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 that way. And you can play that game for 20 minutes with a child who would just pretend that he really wants to do the thing that you don't want him to do over and over and over again, so that you will cuddle him and you will jostle him and you will give him little, you know, playful pats on the belly or a little playful noogie on the head. And you can look at each other a lot while you're doing this, and all of this laughter is going to relax and relax and relax him. And then when you don't want to do this anymore, you just go, okay, we have to stop playing this game. And then you just pick him up and you take him into another room where he can't get at the thing, you know, that he's really fixated on doing. And if he cries then because he's not, you know, because you've stopped playing this wonderful game, stay with him then. It's like he's offloading, you know, the nether regions of the tension that is, you know, been stored up inside of him. And but you don't have to always set limits. Seriously, you can play with limits and still keep the limits. It's like you don't let him play with whatever this is, but you're playful as you stop, you know, as you stop him from getting over there to that little area of the room. So
I think we'll have to say goodbye.
But you know, I hope these ideas are fun to use for you. Okay. Let's see, we have another caller. Go ahead.
Hi, so my question is, my son is, he'll be four next month, and he, you know, everyone comments on his high energy, and he is very high energy. And he does have his calm moments, but when he gets excited and he'll get loud and run all over the place and jump off everything, and, you know, he does a lot of physical activity, but if we're in the house and we can't take him out to ride his bike or something, like, what's the best thing to do to get him to chill out? Because I feel like that's when I get really anxious and frustrated, is he just won't stop. How do you get him to calm down?
Yeah. What kind of thing won't he stop?
Like, he'll start making faces and making sounds and just jumping and you know, flitting around the room and climbing on stuff, like that kind of thing. And, you know, and I'll ask him to, you know, you need to calm down. And he's like, okay. And he'll, you know, say it in some, you know, he'll be goofy and crazy. And he doesn't really stop until he's kind of decided that he wants to, I guess.
Okay. I have a few things to say. I'd love to hear what you have to say too, Robin. What I would do is go with it before you go against it. So when children are really active, they're just itching to laugh. They're itching to use their power. They need a foil. And so if you play with, and if you take the less powerful role and you go, okay, let's do 5 minutes of really, you know, WrestleMania, here we go. And then you get in there and wrestle with him and you lose. Or you have a pillow fight. You gather up the pillows that don't have zippers and don't have little delicate things sewn into them, and just let him womp you, and you womp him back a little bit, and you just get laughter going, and you moderate what you do so that it's you're hitting him just you know, perhaps just with a touch of pillow, and that lets him laugh a lot. Or maybe he's a child who really likes to be walked with a pillow, and that's what lets him laugh a lot. You have to be careful that you're not hurting the child, but, you know, laughter is just a great release, tension release. And so you climb in, you go, okay, WrestleMania, 5 minutes, here we go. And you go with all of that energy so that he's got someone to play with. He's not just bouncing around the room all by himself. And then, and you set a timer, and when the timer goes off, you go, okay, we'll have to wait till tomorrow for more WrestleMania, or maybe, you know, when Daddy gets home, we'll do more WrestleMania. So you promise it again another time. But sometimes that can really help. Sometimes just a 5 or a 10 minute outlet with somebody and with laughter. So it's not just his own isolated energy running around the house, but you chase and you can't catch, or he gets to jump on you and you wrestle him off, something like that can really reassure a child. Fear is is often the cause of children being sort of overactive and unable to settle. And just getting to kind of bang into each other playfully and affectionately is very, very helpful. It just physical contact of a playful but very definite kind, not careful petting, but, you know, horseyback riding where you're trying to buck him off your back onto a soft carpet, that kind of thing can really allow children to survive the unexpected over and over and over again, and this builds their confidence, lets them laugh, and slowly but surely lets them relax. And if 5 or 10 minutes isn't enough, but that's all the time you have, or that's all the patience you have, then you might want to, at the end, you might want to pull them into your arms and just say, okay, let's sit here for a few minutes and wipe our sweat off and, you know, and just kind of, I don't know, just basically notice one another, you know, notice one another's eyelashes or notice one another's teeth or just notice one another and see if he can absorb your caring that way. And if not, you know, just keep your arms around him and say, no, I'm not going to let you run around the house again. And he will fight you and he will have a big cry, and the connection that you're offering will help him relax as he gets the, you know, all of those feelings out of his way. So, Robin, what do you think?
Well, I just love what you have to say about roughhousing with the child and, you know, connecting with him, because some of that kind of high-intensity behavior is anxiety in children because they're not connected and because they don't know how to connect. And also because moving, for all of us, but particularly for children, is regulating. So it's an attempt at being able to stay calm. So the interesting thing is physical movement and connection and attachment, both are soothing. And, you know, if you do get to a point after the first 5 minutes and he wants to do more, I would say, you know, for me, say I would put in my needs, too. He might be calmer by then if he's looking at your eyelashes and he's taken a breather. Say, I need to do something a little not so wild and crazy. Can you help me think about something else we can do? And brainstorm with him and problem solve. Say, when you're jumping all over, I'm a little tired. So is there something else that we can do? Are you hungry? You know, sometimes children behave that way because they have fluctuations in their blood sugar, or they've eaten something that actually is making them that way. So I would check in and see, you know, where is his, is he hungry? Does he need to eat? Can you go take a break and do something else where you're still connected? And maybe propose a couple of ideas and see if he can choose from one of those. So part of what you're doing is trying to offer a variety of ways that you guys can get along and do things together by letting him know that, yeah, you like to wrestle, but not quite as much as he likes to wrestle. But you'll do it sometimes, and then other times you want to do other things. But all of this is in this context that Patty's talking about, where you're really connecting to him and you're touching him, and that's so wonderful to be physically relating to him. My own perspective is I don't do holding of children when they don't want to be held, only because I think for a lot of children that can put them into a kind of state of arousal that I don't necessarily want them to be in, as long as they're in a safe environment. But I definitely think touching them is really important.
Yeah.
And eye contact and all of that. The other thing is, if he's high energy all the time, is, you know, as long as the high energy is manageable and it feels like temperament and it's fine, that's great. But if he's that way to an extreme, I would try to figure out how's he doing in the morning, and is he responding to his environment in a way where he's actually stressed? So is it high energy or is it stress? And if it's stress, I would try to come up with ways to make things a little bit easier on him, where he stays connected to you and he feels a little calmer.
And sorry, how are you saying you can tell the difference between the two?
Well, I think it has to... I think it has to do with how responsive he is to you, you know, whether or not he's able to engage when he's active. When he wakes up in the morning, is he connecting with you? Is he immediately into things, or is he able to drop into reverie and relaxation? So a lot of times, if children aren't able to do that, that's what I would really focus on, is how do I find opportunities to drop into relaxed states with him, whether it's early in the morning when he gets up, we just lay in bed and cuddle and talk, or at night, I just let him talk a lot after the bedtime story and wander around in his ideas. But these kinds of moments where there's prolonged connection that is relaxed. A lot of children that are really kind of hyper are not getting enough connection where they feel connected and where they feel calm.
Yeah. Special time is really good for, you know, helping children feel reassured that they're getting, you know, 100% of your attention. Sometimes children are just, all of the bouncing around is attention-seeking behavior because they feel needy for attention. And it may be that you give them a lot of attention, but they have this feeling of need that comes from some difficult time in their past when they really did need, you know, closeness and attention. And maybe they were in the hospital in an incubator, or maybe, you know, they, you know, their daddy had to go on a long trip and they missed him and they've never had a chance to work on the feelings that come from scary times. And so the feeling of need is kind of, it's an ever-present feeling. No matter how much attention you give them, they still feel like they need more. And when children feel that, again, you want to go with what they want to do. You want to make sure that there are times every day when he can be as active as he wants and you can get a lot of laughter going. And then you use limits at the other times. And that's where, you know, it's like if a child can't, and this is just a general idea of how you set limits, if you ask a child to settle down and not run around the house and not jump all over the couch one time and they can't do it, then they've shown you that they can't think and they've shown you they don't feel connected enough to cooperate. And so at that point, that's when we tell parents to move in rather than yell another direction, yell at, you know, a second or a third, you know, come on, get off the couch, I told you this, or if you don't get off the couch, I'm going to X, Y, or Z. You've got a child who can't think. If they can't cooperate with you, if they can't stop what they're doing, you know, after you've said it's important to you that they stop, then don't waste your breath trying to make their brain work and make their brain take in the verbal direction you're giving. They've shown you that they can't think, and that's the time to move, to go over and to put your arms around them and say, I'm not going to let you jump on the couch anymore. And you're not squeezing them, you're not pinning them down, you're providing a container and allowing them, if they need to do babble. You know, what often happens is they'll just laugh and run away, and then then you go and you bring the limit again. But announcing the limit from 5 feet away is one of the reasons that parents think, is that they keep imagining that their child will be able to process the orders that they're issuing. And the child shows over and over again that they cannot process those orders, that they are feeling really disconnected and they cannot think. They can't really relate to the parent at all. And that's the time to bring not a harsh limit, not a spanking, not anything. You just, you know, move in and you physically make your child stop, with no harshness whatsoever and no, you know, no loud words, no put downs. You just say, sorry, not going to let you do that. And then you connect. What they're looking for, what they need in order for their minds to get back in gear is a connection. And if you really need to stop them, then you stop them and allow them to work themselves into, you know, laughter or tears or whatever it is that's going to let that emotional tension out of their way so that they can feel the connection that you're offering. And in order to be able to do this well, you need good emotional support yourself. I don't advocate holding children just out of nowhere, but if a child is off track and they can't stop themselves, it's much better sort of family health-wise to move in and bring a gentle but firm limit. And that will usually trigger an offload of a tantrum or upset, crying, laughter that helps them reconnect.
I also really love this idea of special time, Patty, that you talk about, because it's this kind of way that you stop the world and you're just melting with that child in that moment. And it's that beingness place, that calm place where there's no pressure. It's just this moment where you're together outside of the harried, busy world and all the demands and things you have to do. And if you do that every day, regularly, that creates a patterned experience of my mom or my dad is with me, and they're just with me.
Yeah.
I think it's incredibly powerful to find these places where we can be with our child, where there's nothing to do. Because part of what we're trying to build in is this regulation before he's jumping on the couch, before he's lost control, before he's wound up because it's a long day. And if we catch that early, we can get him into a calmer state sooner where he feels good.
Yeah. So, Robin, I think we've used up the time that we have here. I know that people would love to hear more about the resources you offer, and I think you mentioned a booklet that you would like to send them a link to. So could you tell people how they can get a hold of you and what kinds of resources you offer?
Yes, that would be wonderful. You can go to stopspanking.org, and you'll find some videos. You'll see that there's a page that says Alternatives to Spanking, and at the bottom of that page there's all sorts of research. There's also a tab called Articles, and you can just page through tons of articles that address all sorts of research. And you can, of course, email me at Robin, R-O-B-B-Y-N, Peters, P-E-T-E-R-S, at comcast.net, and ask me for whatever you want. We have a pamphlet as well, if you have people that you want to share your concerns with in a gentle way, I'd be more than willing to send that to you as well.
Okay. I think, is that the pamphlet that you sent me the link to, Robin?
It is.
Yeah, okay. All of you who were here tonight and everyone else who signed up for the teleseminar but couldn't come because of time zone issues or, you know, family dinner issues, you will all be sent the link to the pamphlet that Robin just mentioned. So, thank you. And from Hand in Hand side, you can learn more about our listening tools by going to handinhandparenting.org. We have booklets there, and we have self-guided courses. We have a course that we call Building Emotional Understanding, which is a course where you can get mentoring using these listening tools with your children, and listening time as well. You can find out what it feels like to be supported emotionally, and you can listen to other parents and their issues and their how it works for them when they use listening tools. It's a really good learning environment, and you can do it either locally or you can do it via conference call with us. And where we'd like to send you most right now is to get our self-guided course called Setting Limits and Building Cooperation. And it's over 3 hours of video of me talking to you about your child's emotions and your child's behavior and how you can move in to guide your child rather than grow up and do the things that happened in your family growing up. There's also several sections in there on what to do with your own feelings when your child triggers them and you're not behaving the way you intended to behave as a parent. We all get caught there many times, sometimes every single day. And so there's no shame in getting caught there, but we are able to be responsible people and figure out new strategies. So there's more strategies are in that course, and you can download it and start it tonight if you want. It's called Setting Limits and Building Cooperation, and you can find it on our website. So thank you, Robin. I think you have such good information, and it's really clear that your caring for parents goes deep, and your understanding of how we all get caught in this difficulty around harshness with our children is really, listen to you.
Well, thank you so much, Patty, for having a chance to talk with you and your listeners. It's just great to be able to be here tonight, and I just appreciate that very much.
Yeah.
And I love what hand-in-hand parenting is doing. It's marvelous.
Thank you. And I really learned some things about self-regulation and what helps us to come back to our right minds when we've been triggered. It's really very, very helpful information. So thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Hand in Hand is here to help you get the support you need for your work as a parent. To download podcasts on additional parenting topics, go to handinhandparenting.org/store. We look forward to connecting with you again soon.